Blog Talk Radio.
What's going on with these polls? confirm in my anecdotal experience with friends and colleagues in Cuba confirm that, is that Cubans don't want the United States government, or any other foreign government for that matter, to interfere with their own problems. And many Cubans say, yeah, there are problems in this country, but not everything is bad. So we want to resolve those problems ourselves without foreign interference. And let's do that. And to a degree, what the United States has done is a turnaround on this issue. What President Obama has signaled is that the policy of seeking regime change by blocking Cuba has failed. But what he has not admitted is that the United States still has programs in place. We're spending taxpayer dollars to the tune of somewhere between $30 and $40 million a year on programs that are directly aiming at overthrowing the Cuban government.
For example?
There's direct support for opposition groups in Cuba. And these are opposition groups that are closely aligned with the now U.S. Embassy and the U.S. government's interests. The Cuban government's reaction has been these are agents paid by a foreign government, and therefore we're going to crack down on them with our legal system. This has led to an escalation with the United States supporting even more of these groups, and it's just not productive. I mean, if you are a Cuban and you are known of receiving U.S. government money, you're just not well seen. And I'm not talking about the government. I'm talking about regular Cubans. So this is one of those programs. You've heard probably about Alan Gross, the USAID subcontractor who was arrested the, I think, 10th time or so he flew to Cuba to deploy communications devices for Jewish communities in Cuba. He was paid with U.S. taxpayer dollars, and he was part, this was part of one of those programs. He traveled to Cuba as a tourist, and after the 10th time, the Cuban government said, we're fed up with this, we're going to arrest this guy as an undeclared agent of the U.S. government. And they did, and this led to all kinds of complications. The guy has been released. He's, by the way, advocating normalization of relations between the United States and Cuba now. But these programs are not finished. We continue to fund those programs.
So you're saying the Congress is pushing these programs, or are they? Is anyone calling for their end? I mean, since we're going to all this other trouble, is the Congress, where are they?
There are some parts of the program, such as our taxpayer-funded broadcast programs to Cuba. Some Congress people have launched initiatives to stop funding radio and TV marquee in Miami. This is a separate expense that I didn't even include in the $30 to $40 million a year we're spending on regime change. Radio and TV marquee are having a budget of, I believe, somewhere between $20 and $30 million a year. And they're broadcasting their signal to Cuba in violation of international telecommunications agreements. The Cubans have been protesting that, and the United Nations is agreeing with the Cuban stance that this is illegal, but we still have Radio TV Marti sending that signal. And there are some Congress people who would like to end funding Radio TV Marti, but this is still a minority, and the bill is winding its way through Congress with no momentum.
Who's supporting it, and who's not supporting that bill?
Who is supporting Radio and TV Marti, or the bill?
The bill.
This is a bipartisan effort. I'm not sure exactly which Congress people are supporting, are sponsoring.
The bill is designed to end Radio Marti, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the ones who are supporting it are the conservatives, essentially, and a few of the...
No, it's not as easy. This is it's crossing party lines.
Mm-hmm.
There are Republicans, particularly some with libertarian inclinations, who are opposed to this kind of foreign policy tools. I'm thinking about Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, for instance. He has been a very outspoken and adamant critic of the U.S.-Cuba policy, and he's been advocating an end of the embargo for many years now. And he's taking a leadership within the Republican Party on this issue.
Mm. Well, Flake was there when Obama met with Castro. He was getting photographed right along because of his position. So, what is his? And he's in the Congress, in the House, right?
He's a senator for Arizona.
Oh, he's the other senator along with McCain.
Correct.
Oh, okay. Senator Jeff Flake. You're right about that, of course. That being the case, he'll be around a while to help to steer it through his own party, I would think. It sounds like the Southern conservatives and the Cubans in Miami are still having a lot of power on these things. Are they going to
Well, I always object to the term the Cubans in Miami.
Okay. All right.
The three Cuban-American representatives for South Florida in the House of Representatives are adamantly pro-embargo and anti-Castro, but I would argue that they don't represent the Cuban-American vote in this regard. Cuban-American voters, according to surveys, are very much in favor of lifting the travel ban and allowing everybody to travel freely to Cuba. This is partly, in their own interest, because most Cuban Americans want to be in touch with their relatives and their own families without any obstacles thrown in their way by the U.S. government.
Well, Rubio being one of the ones wanting to maintain the embargo.
He's taken a leadership role in this, and I must say I almost admire him for this, because it's a principled stand that's going to make him lose votes at this point.
Oh, really?
So, I tip my hat to his consistency on the issue, but, I mean, if I were a political consultant, I would tell him to get the hell out of this topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, Johannes, isn't he doing this really for presidential reasons, like Donald Trump making the case that he's making on illegals? I mean, of course, Cubans have an exception. We set it up that they can automatically become citizens if they come to our shore. But other...
Well, I agree. There's a bigger issue involved here, and it is about the U.S.-Israel relationship, and it is about the projection of U.S. power to the rest of the world. He could gain votes by being the presidential candidate who is tough in foreign policy, who is going to send, signals of willingness to go to the extreme to anyone who dares challenging U.S. supremacy in the world. So it could be that he's trying to project this kind of a foreign policy image in the course of the presidential campaign. And that's a discussion we really need to have. I mean, me being strongly involved with this Cuba issue, I've been following the Iran nuclear deal on the sidelines, but I am under the impression that the United States foreign policy has finally reached a stage in which we officially recognize the real power, or the lack thereof, of the United States of America, and adapting our foreign policy to this new reality. We're living in a multipolar world. but we still are funding the biggest military machine in the history of humankind.
Now you're making that connection in terms of being willing to step aside and allow others to run things as they see fit, or what's our role in that circumstance? I mean, we've carry a big stick has been the rule of the Caribbean all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt, and now you have Obama pulling away the curtain of Cuba. It's been a symbol for that. And now in Iran, you have the same kind, a major country, really, and going to be much more so because Iran is going to spread and become all of what was southern Iraq, in my opinion, along with Syria. That's all going to become one country under the governing of the Shia in Tehran. So when you have that kind of circumstance, what is the splash effect of the Cuba thing? Is there anything similar in Central and South America?
Well, the Caribbean, Central America has been traditionally considered the backyard of the United States of America. Our foreign policy makers have assumed that we control everything that's happening in that part of the world. And Cuba had been the long-time exception to this. Now we're realizing that it's not our backyard. We have major foreign players gaining strength and influence in the Caribbean and Central America. I mean, it's amazing when you go to a place like Managua or Panama and you see the visible amount of Chinese presence, European presence, Russian presence in those places, and the minimal presence in the United States, minus the military and a huge embassy.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a big challenge for the United States of America in recognizing these new realities on the ground. We are dealing with not only the Europeans, with a set of world powers that are showing increasingly their cultural, economic, political presence in areas that we used to dominate and control almost entirely. And I would assume the U.S. move of seeking normalization with Cuba is trying to get rid of this exception and being able to focus again more energy on trying to regain some of the lost influence.
I said,
let me give out the call number.
Sure.
All right, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is 347-989-0132. That's 347-989-0132.
And we have 945-741-745-1490. But right now the lines probably are tied by the technical stuff we're in. Is there one open at all?
No, those lines are all busy. So really the only number to call is 347-989-0132. We have 1,000 lines open there.
Well, yeah, but the locals need to know that their line will come to them. But this is because we're in an interview that requires two lines. Johannes, the matter of recognizing what's happening in Central and South America is, when you talk to people in this country, oh, well, it's the Mexicans. There's 30 million Mexicans. Oops, nope, there's 90 million Mexicans. Oops, they're all illegal. They're all, Donald Trump tells us that they're all criminals and everything, lowlife and so on. And the oligarchs are running the show. Oh, you mean they're going to put a canal through Nicaragua? What is the story on that?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay. The question goes to the attitudes of the United States. People speak about what they think is true and what actually becomes fact. I mean, as I mentioned, the population of Mexico, I think the city of Mexico alone is about 30 million, but the population of Mexico is around 90 overall. Maybe Mexico is even larger.
It's actually more than 100 million.
It's over 100 million now. Wow. So what is the impact of the if the Nicaraguan Panama parallel happens, another canal? What happens in that circumstance?
Well, this is one of the the realities that have not filtered into the public mind of the United States population in general. This is a project, a $30 billion project that's privately funded by a consortium from Hong Kong, a Chinese consortium. They're building a canal that would be bigger than the Panama Canal. Construction has started, but of course this is a mega project and it's facing major challenges. The U.S. attitude, also the U.S. government's attitude, so far has been it ain't gonna happen. That's why we're not concerned about it.
Ain't gonna happen? Why is that?
Well, it could fall apart if they're facing funding shortages, for instance. I mean, the project is only funded in phases, but it only makes sense when each phase is completed. So so if phase one is completed and it ends in Lake Nicaragua without connecting the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, it's, of course, isn't worth anything. So funding could be a problem. Political change in Nicaragua could be a problem. Say if there would be an overthrow of a government and the new government says, no, we don't want this. That could be a challenge. You never know. I mean, these are huge projects and the challenges are as big as that. But I think it's very important for Americans to know that this is happening, that it might even come to a successful conclusion. And what does this mean? This is a canal that's not under the control of the United States. It would be an economic factor that would increase trade and traffic in the Gulf of Mexico, in the ports, the United States ports. It's a project that could have a lot of ripple effects, and we should know about it.
It's
also directed at Mexican migration. This is also a factor that involves a lot of ignoring of reality. Each one of us here in the United States already has friends or relatives that are a result of migration from Mexico. The Mexican part of the United States of America has become mainstream. Cinco de Mayo has been adopted by Budweiser, and tacos have become the regular item on a fast food menu. It's Mexico and Mexican immigration to the United States is. Mexican immigrants are as American as apple pie, I would argue.
But they're also North Americans. You know, I mean.
And the fear mongering is misplaced because the long term trends are telling us that Mexican migration to the United States is going to shrink. A demographic fact.
Well, the irony is North America extends to the border, the southern border of Mexico, and then becomes Central America, and Mexicans are as North American as you or I. Do you want to give up?
Geographically, part of Mexico. It's about half of Mexico is geographically part of North America.
Right, right.
It doesn't make a difference if you're a person, whether you live south or north of that.
Mm-hmm.
Geographic defines North America.
Do you want to give out that number again, Mitch?
It's 347-989-0132. I want to say yesterday I flew back from Las Vegas. I was out there for a week, and I flew through Miami through American Airlines. And I was walking through the terminal. I looked over, and then there was one of the gates was departing to Havana, Cuba at 11:20 a.m. through, I guess it's Sun Country. I took a picture of it, and I just posted it up on my Facebook wall. So my name's Mitch Mallett. If you're not a friend of mine, go ahead and friend me. You can view it. And they have regular flights now from Miami to Cuba.
Sun Country Airline, it looks like, in flight 883. You missed your flight if you didn't get on that flight.
You wouldn't have had to worry because there, I believe it's now 50 flights a week from Miami to Cuba. And there are 8 flights a week from Tampa to Cuba. It's not a big deal. It's really, it's a reality.
It's a norm.
Well, no, the reality is that it is a reality because you don't have to go up to Canada or to Mexico or somewhere else to fly to Cuba. You can now fly from the United States. It's just the beginning. And as demand kicks in, I'm sure other airlines will be wanting to have routes to Cuba and the normalization.
What's still standing in the way, these are small charter airlines because we don't have an aviation agreement with Cuba. The regular scheduled flights are not allowed. In other words, the Deltas and American Airlines and so on cannot fly directly to Cuba. So these are small operators, and there are many of them. And Americans who travel have to sign an affidavit that they're not going to have fun. I'm always a bit facetious about this, but we're allowed to travel to Cuba under 12 categories, and it doesn't include tourism. So
well, what if you said educational pleasure?
Exactly. I mean, you can travel for
but if you
purposes,
said
religious purposes, even on business, but you're not allowed to hang out on the beach.
Well, when do you think that normalization's gonna basically kick in?
Well, efforts are underway in Congress. I mean, the executive has done pretty much what it can at this point, using its power to normalize relations. But much of the U.S. sanction is encoded in law, and so it's up to Congress to lift those sanctions. There was a Senate committee yesterday, for instance, passed a bill that would lift the travel ban. It's now going to a vote on the Senate floor, and there is a corresponding bill in the House. We don't know whether there's a majority for that at this point.
And do you support that?
The Republican-controlled Congress is still throwing a tantrum at the president against everything, anything the president does, and that includes the normalization process with Cuba. And so it could well be that it's still held up by the Republican majority.
Well, the whole ball game is starting to show signs that there's reason, and as money starts to flow, there's going to be more reason, and change is at hand. But locally here at Port Manatee, is it still in the running for being one of the ports? Or do you know?
It is in a very good position. It's the port geographically closest to the new mega hub in Cuba, the port of Mariel. There are freight operations that Port Manatee is interested in, but major cargo operations won't be happening until the trade embargo is lifted. Another exemption the U.S. government has granted is now passenger service. United States has allowed about a half dozen operators to establish ferry service between Florida ports and Cuba, and it's now up to the Cuban government to select those operators. Two of those operators have expressed interest in running service from Port Manatee to Havana. So Port Manatee is in a pretty good situation in regards to the ferries. There have also been some developments in the cruise business. Carnival Cruises, surprisingly nimble, has announced that they will introduce people-to-people cruises next year, starting in May, with a 700-passenger ship going out of Miami and probably offering an around-the-island tour of Cuba. The U.S. government has allowed that, and the Cubans are quite interested in increasing their cruise business as well. So you have Carnival, and you have half a dozen small operators that are now beginning to offer cruises from the United States to Cuba?
Well, you know, just yesterday or today, the Germans have sent a delegation down to Tehran, even though the seeming agreement is just that, seeming. When these agreements are struck, the people, and there's real anger in Germany for them doing it. I forget what the companies are. So when now that this has happened, I'm sure the businesses of America have gotten on board, and you know, they will pull, they'll wag, that tail will wag the dog, I would say.
Yes, but it's not happening that quickly.
Oh, really?
There's an interesting little blog entry by the CEO and president of Marriott International, the big hotel concern.
Mm-hmm.
He traveled to Cuba and talked to all kinds of people, and what most impressed him was seeing his European, Asian, Latin American competitors
already there,
investing heavily in hotels in Cuba right now, trying to anticipate the arrival of the Americans. And so he returned with a kind of urgent message saying, look, this is what's happening. We really need to get our act together here.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, you see some corporate engagement at this point. There is a new PAC that was founded. It's called Engage Cuba, and it is funded mostly by agribusinesses, but tourism-related companies, transportation companies are moving into the act as well. And they've raised about $400,000 in the course of this year, which matches more or less the contributions of the anti-Castro pro-embargo PAC. So you're beginning to see some equivalency in Congress.
Well, getting comfortable in these circumstances, and Obama getting a lot of legacy in this whole thing, has got these people scratching their head what to do next. And on top of that, Mr. Trump is winning in the polling among the whites, who are basically all that's left of the Republican Party. It's kind of a curious thing. Of course, he's on the one hand, he deprecates the people. On the other hand, he said they love me. But in the case of Obama, it seems as though he is winning the ball game when you get right down to the international relations, first with Cuba, then with Iran. Actually, Iran's been in the cooker for over 2 years. I don't know how long was the obvious effort to come together with Cuba. How long ago was that?
It was about a two-year effort.
Okay, so about the same.
It started with informal negotiations for Alan Gross, the USAID subcontractor that was imprisoned in Cuba. And it turned into something bigger with the mediation of the new pope.
The
Vatican played an important role, and Canada held offering the venue for secret meetings. So this is a process that took about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very conscious effort. And I must say, you know, if you want a pragmatic foreign policy, there it is. In the case of Cuba, I've been seeing year after year after year. Let's talk about dollars and cents. The United States had been spending hundreds of millions of dollars on overthrowing that government. At one point, it was even considering reviving the Fifth Fleet for billions of dollars in operations costs in order to send a military signal to all the dissenters south of our border. So we've been spending billions of dollars aligning, quote-unquote, aligning dissidents south of our border with no to no avail. What we've seen in the course of the past 6 months since the United States announced normalization is a huge increase in influence of the United States in Cuba and in Latin America, I might say, because Latin Americans have been telling the U.S. for years that they should normalize relations with Cuba. So bottom line, dollars and cents, I think this foreign policy makes so much more sense than overthrow and regime change.
We're going to come to a break right now, Johannes. Can you hold a little after the break?
Sure.
Thank you.
This part of the Morning Edge is brought to you by Callens, Little & Delgado, practicing personal injury, criminal defense, and family law. Call 941-749-1446. 941-749-1446. Home to a true gift, the Posture Clinic of Sarasota, with Dr. Mark D'Amato, 4450 South Tamiami Trail. Dr. D'Amato is a veterinary chiropractor, treating horses, dogs, or your favorite four-legged friend. First and foremost, animal chiropractic care is not intended to replace traditional veterinary medicine. Complementary care is the type of care that works with your vets, and certainly not instead of them. To find out more information, call Dr. Mark D'Amato at 941-927-7009. That's 941-927-7009. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Mark treats two-legged patients, too.
Well, he's only, he gives people treatment 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
Ah, there you go.
We're back on. Johannes, the ball game that's being played here is...
Let me just give out the number.
Yes, well, the calling number. I don't keep that off the top of my head, so you might repeat it.
Right. So if you'd like to call in, it's 347-989-0132. That's 347-989-0132.
It's an online number that you can call a regular line. Johannes, you're working right out of Sarasota here, so you're local to us, but your relationship goes beyond that. Isn't that true?
Well, Cuba Standard is an information service that lives off subscriptions, and the bulk of our subscribers is... of course, not in Sarasota. In fact, we only have two subscribers in Sarasota. Our biggest markets are Havana. A lot of foreign companies that do business in Cuba subscribe to our service, as do a surprising number of Cubans. A big chunk is in places like New York, Miami. Canada is important for us, and then Britain, Spain, Germany, Netherlands, Russia, Hong Kong. Our readers are all over the place.
No, your service is what exactly?
Well, we're providing breaking news on our website, www.cubastandard.com. We're really keeping the pulse of the Cuban economy and the politics surrounding that. We're providing an offline monthly that provides more context and graphics, maps. This is stuff you can use if you invest in Cuba, if you sell to Cuba. And then we provide a quarterly economic trend report that provides trend and analysis for tools like a GDP trend tool and a business confidence survey. If you're doing business in Cuba, this is the report that gives you the early warning signs.
You keep in any contact with anyone? I mean, is it Carlos Basquet, who's head of the manager for the Port Manatee? Do you ever keep up with what he's doing, or do they make contact?
Carlos Boqueira is a good friend, of course. I like to be in touch with people close to home who are dealing with Cuba, and he's a very active person. He's exactly the right person in growing Port Manatee's traffic. He's a native Catalan from Barcelona.
Oh, he is. I didn't know he was Catalan. Oh, really?
He speaks Castilian, of course. He's fluent in Spanish, and he can relate to port managers, business people, politicians. south of our border, he's really the perfect man in this position for Fortinet.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's you have the class system in among the Hispanics. And if there ever is one that's clear and almost unadulterated, it would be the Catalan influence in Spain and in the Basque group as well as in opposites.
Can I ask a question?
Well, sure, go ahead.
I want to ask you, if full normalization is in place with Cuba, what kind of positive impact would that have on the Florida economy and certainly the greater Tampa Bay area?
Well, I'm always a believer on the tide that raises all boats. If we hold back the Cuban economy, if we shrink it, overall we're worse off than if we allow the Cuban economy to flourish. In other words, Florida and business in Florida will have positive side effects if the Cuban economy grows. There are some people who perceive challenges. For instance, the biggest Florida Agriculture Association, for some reason, believes that their members will be suffering of more competition. I would argue that's not true. The biggest agricultural players are already eyeing Cuba in terms of a place where they can cultivate crops, and it's also a place where they can sell crops. Cuba has a pretty dysfunctional agriculture at this point. They need to import 70% of Cuba's calorie intake. So it's actually good business for Florida agriculture. Mm. Tourism, I would argue Florida is becoming a more interesting spot to travel to. If you're a German or a Swede or a Canadian, I would go to Florida in winter and then spend another $1,000 on a cruise to Cuba from there, why not? I mean, Cuba is so close, you can spend a weekend in Havana and then come back to Florida where you feel maybe more at ease than you would in a foreign-speaking country, in a Spanish-speaking country.
What about the idea that, why bother going to Florida? It's going to be cheaper in Cuba. Tourism is going to fall off for Florida. Oh, and the sugar industry is going to be competitive, and therefore sugar is going to be affected. The subsidies in the United States on sugar, all these things are factors that are political, because Florida often is looked at in terms of sugar because of what's run the politics for years and years is sugar. So, and the citrus industry, I'm not sure about that as well. Those three things, how does that work out?
You're right. Each of these industries you're mentioning is facing their particular challenges by an opening Cuba. But I would argue, things always change. You have to adapt. If you insist on the old ways of doing things, you're going to go down. If you find new ways of doing business, you're going to be winning.
But isn't the political power of Tallahassee in the sugar industry one and the same? They really have dictated a great deal. There's even the developers have lined up to block high-speed rail through the politics because they don't want the land on either side of I-75 and 94, 95, whatever it is, to have a rail. Because it's going to move people too quickly away from what is unending building of housing all over the place that doesn't do much for anything but temporary people and no real solid populace. You've got these interests that are so entrenched. You're right, it needs to change, but what's going to really shake it out is the question.
Well, I can answer to you with an example. These interests are broader than you would assume. Yes, they have been, the sugar interests have been defending the quota system and the federal subsidies. They've been able to holding on to them with tooth and claws and nails, and so the system is still there. And once Cuba opens up, this system will be challenged more than ever. So they stand to lose that. But what I know is, for instance, the Fanjul brothers, they are Cuban Americans. They left the country after the revolution, and they rebuilt their sugar empire from Palm Beach, and they have become advocates of normalization with Cuba now. They would like to put their money into the Cuban sugar industry. And this is not something totally different. Yes, they have a lot of operations in Florida where they grow sugar cane, but they have bigger operations in the Dominican Republic and in Mexico and in Panama.
That raises
not really that big a difference for them.
That raises an interesting thing. You have the Dominican Republic on one side of that island, and the other Haiti, which is a disaster. And after the earthquake, you would have thought Haiti would have been revived and rebuilt. The monies that were supposed to go there have been filtered out and ruined. Haiti still is the mess that it always was, and the politics and all of the rest and the racism are a big factor. Is Cuba in a position in any way to influence that real change that needs to happen on that land?
Well, they've taken a very constructive role in Haiti before and after the earthquake. I would dare to say that their healthcare support they provided has been the most effective support that's been coming from the outside. I'm always a strong believer in solutions from the inside. So all this AIDS syndrome is great to have an inclination towards wanting to help, but solutions have to come from the inside. And this is why the Cuban support has been so effective. What they've done is they've not only sent Cuban doctors to trade Haitians, but they've sent Cuban healthcare experts to rebuild or effectively build a healthcare infrastructure in Haiti. And they've been very successful. They've been funded, by the way. The Cuban doctors have been funded by third nations. Brazil has been a big donor. Norway has been a big donor for the Cuban effort in Haiti. Venezuela has been a big donor. So they played a major stabilizing role in Haiti over the past 5 years.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that was promised to Haiti was a massive rebuilding of housing for people, and it's my understanding that less than 10 houses were ever built, and the money was spent. The Red Cross is involved in up to their eyeballs in corruption and things like that. It just doesn't seem to happen there.
Well, you're talking about a country that has been unable to build institutions, and there are many reasons for that, many of them internal, but I would also argue that Haiti has been the most punished country in this hemisphere, beginning with the French, who never pardoned the Haitian slaves daring to overthrow their rule. Essentially, the French forced Haiti to repay, quote-unquote repay, the debt from colonial times, and Haiti had been paying that until the 1930s. Eventually, the United States took over as the other patron, quote-unquote patron, but our role has been eminently destabilizing for Haiti and Haiti's institutions. I would only remind you of Aristide. He was a very popular president, re-elected twice in Haiti. It was on the United States watch and with the United States support that Aristide was overthrown.
What was his name again?
Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
Aristide, yes, that's right.
He is controversial because he was a populist, not exactly Hugo Chavez style, but he had strong inclinations towards redistribution, and the upper class never pardoned him.
Well, this is
so they managed his overthrow with the
help of us.
Implicit support of the United States.
During the Clinton administration.
By the way, a CIA plane on which we put Aristide on his flight to nowhere, to Central Africa,
mm-hmm.
into exile. And we are, the United States, his still a power which tells Aristide, who is now back in Haiti, to not get involved in any politics. I know many people who know Haiti will now yell at me and say, this is a demagogue, he's a populist.
Of course he was.
Terrible for the country. Yes, maybe he is, but he was eminently popular. If you overthrow an eminently popular president, what's going to happen to the institutions representing that state? Obviously, the people will believe that they're all controlled by those
This seems to be the affliction of the United States. We had to issue a formal apology through our CIA to open the door to negotiate with Tehran over the Iran deal. And here we are with this little country of Haiti, having done in this, I think it's during the Clinton administration, having done the same thing. And I read at the time Aristide's involvements and his interests, and it was clear that he cared about these people and people cared about him. And then you get a leader that's effective, well, you don't have to kill him, you just get him moved out of his job. That's the history of the United States with countries that don't cooperate. And if we don't change this sort of thing, and bringing Cuba in here to do what Cuba's doing along with the openness that seems to be happening, this is quite a change that we're into. I'm hoping more for it. I was very depressed that Aristide was taken away, and we had to impose ourselves. And when Bill Clinton went down there after the earthquake and promised everything, and frankly, I've been always impressed with Bill Clinton until the Haiti experiment was such a failure.
Well, I agree with you. It's time for us to take part in U.S. foreign policy. This is something we voters love to delegate to the experts, but the experts in Washington have been wrong for so many years. They've been stuck in the 20th century, in the 1990s, still believing that we are the supreme world power that can control and should control everything. This is a different world. We need to adapt to that new reality.
This the Iranian discussions are really bringing this out. And people think it was just the United States that was doing the negotiating. In fact, there were five other countries. And this whole, and the interest of the other countries to show concern and consideration for the other countries is really, if nothing else, benign power of a great country. Instead of being the overt, I'll step on you if you get in my way, attitude that's been the case. I carry a big stick. A club, if necessary, whatever else works. Change. It's a dark-skinned man that's doing it, and we just can't handle dark-skinned people very well, Johannes.
Well, I won't even get into the issue of white man burden, but what I can tell you is that carrying a big stick is eminently expensive, and at this point, it's the Chinese who grant us the loans that enable us to carry the big stick, and we can't sustain that.
Well, they've been buying up the treasuries, but actually they're only about 9% of the purchasers. I think the U.S. itself has purchased in the vicinity of 80%. So our debt is really our own debt, our own remortgaging and refinancing, and how long we can do that and how much printing can we do. But, yeah, they're the biggest single purchaser of our treasuries, the Chinese are. There's no doubt about that. Well, this has been a great conversation, Johannes. I really appreciate your coming on the air, and we want to do this, as I said, at least once a month. So if there's anything new on the horizon that you want to bring forward or thing you see now that you will be wanting to talk about, why don't you mention it as we close?
Thanks for having me, Augie, and I will keep my eye on Cuba and on Latin America. That's what I'm doing.
Well, you see the splash of what you're doing and what they're doing and what we're doing about that is a rather interesting one, a learning thing that we're getting into something. We're being forced to see things that we have not wanted to look at for a long, long time. So I want to thank you again, Johannes.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, there you have it. Q Cuba, a little country, but with a big...
You're listening to 1490 AM, WWPR, Bradenton, Sarasota, Tampa Bay.
And we will come back and see you on, or listen to you if you call in to listen to each other and have that conversation on Monday. We can talk about Cuba, we can talk about Iran. And
talk about the minimum wage going up in New York.
And that is a big deal, yeah. Yeah, so anyway, there's a big argument going on. It should be $12 instead of $15, and no big jobs, and you can't afford it, and blah, 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 blah.
If you're a fast food worker in New York, it'll be $15 an hour.
Yeah, your hamburgers are going to go up.
Not much. Really, not much.
No, that's not true. Anyway, we will see you on Monday.
All right, we're out of here.
At least 13 rounds were fired during the time he was in the theater discharging the weapon.
Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal says he understands how angry people are in Louisiana and the rest of the country when something like this happens.
We're angry about the evil that exists in our world, about these senseless, apparently senseless acts of violence.
This theater goer, Robert Martinez, told KATC-TV at first he had no idea what was going on when the commotion broke out.
All I thought was people running out, and I thought maybe they got caught watching a movie they weren't supposed to. And the next thing I see is a lady full of blood in a dress, and then they said there's a gun.
Authorities say so far they have yet to determine a motive. Indiana State Police say five people were killed in a seven-vehicle crash on Interstate 65 near Lafayette. State Police Sergeant Kim Riley says it seems a semi-driver went into a construction area too fast, setting off a deadly chain reaction.
There will not be any charges pending reference to the vehicle that started all. That driver was killed.
And three of those killed were in a minivan, two parents and their young child. A fire burning about 35 miles east of Northern California's Napa Valley wine country, now threatening 200 homes. Cal Fire spokesman Amy Head blames the hot, dry weather conditions.
We had very erratic winds, and coupled with the fourth year of drought, the fire grew at a very dangerous rate of spread and was very active and very explosive.
More than 10.5 square miles have already been burned. On Wall Street, looking good for the Dow in early trading. It's up 10 points. This is SRN News.
Do you have a family member who's getting older and can no longer be safely left alone? With Visiting Angels, America's Choice in Senior Home Care, your parents and older family members can continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Experienced, compassionate caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meal preparation, and light housework up to 24 hours per day at affordable rates. To restore your family's peace of mind, call Visiting Angels toll-free today at 877-374-LIVE or at visitingangels.com.
The following is a real-life story from Trinity Debt Management.
I had numerous credit cards, and I was struggling with paying them off, so I made the call.
If you're in debt and you need help, call Trinity at 1-800-758-5360.
The people at Trinity are very friendly. They will do whatever you need them to do in order for you to feel better about being in a very difficult place.
If your debt has you down, call Trinity at 1-800-758-5360.
President Obama is embarking on his fourth trip to Africa while in office and his first visit to Kenya as president. We get more from White House correspondent Greg Cluxton.
Kenya is the homeland of the president's father, and it's Barack Obama's first time visiting in nearly 30 years. Security concerns and the logistics of presidential travel will keep him at a distance from most Kenyans. For example, the president will skip a visit to the rural village where his father was born and buried. Mr. Obama will attend 2 days of events in Kenya before traveling to Ethiopia. Greg Clugston, SRN News, The White House.
Investors helped Amazon.com celebrate its 20th birthday in style by pushing the online retailer stock up 17% in aftermarket trading yesterday. That was on news of a surprise second quarter profit. Amazon always doing a lot of revenue, not always making a lot of profits. It came as a surprise. That's why the market's doing well. Amazon stock up 78 points. This is SRN News. Sharp body, sharp mind, the old saying goes. Well, now SRN's Linda Kenyon reports a new study says regular exercise may help to fight off Alzheimer's disease.
New research suggests working up a good sweat may also offer some help once memory starts to slide and even improve life for people with Alzheimer's. A series of studies reported at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference said the effects were modest but still significant. The findings say vigorous workouts by people with mild memory impairment decreased levels levels of a faulty protein linked to risk of later Alzheimer's.
That's our friend Linda Kenyon reporting. The European Medicines Agency, meanwhile, recommending that the world's leading malaria vaccine be licensed, even though it's only about 30% effective. The drug maker GlaxoSmithKline has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on the vaccine. It is intended for use in the areas of the world with the highest malaria rates. More details at srnnews.com.
The human body is more than 60% water. Your brain and muscles are 75% water. And your blood is 92% water. Water is vital to your body, and alkalizing your water is the key to keep it running at its best. AlkaVision Plasma pH drops keep your entire body healthy, boosts energy, promotes weight loss, and even fights cancer. Call 800-518-7615 or go to AlkaVision.com to find out more. That's ALKAVision.com.
By now you know that wireless technology like cell phones do in fact pose dangers to the health and privacy of everyone. Lockit Pocket's wide range of products are unmatched in providing the protection you deserve. No scare tactics, just common sense. LockitPocket.com offers quality American-made options to alleviate and eliminate these invisible dangers. Learn more at LockitPocket.com or call 888-315-9618. LockitPocket.com, enhancing health and privacy.
Transmission begin.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This is the Josh Tolley Show on the GCN Radio Network.
Another theater shooting. This one happened in Lafayette last night, Louisiana. Welcome to the show, folks. My name is Josh Tully. This is the Josh Tully Show on the GCN Radio Network. If you want to be part of it today, 1-800-259-5791. 1-800-259-5791. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, all those fun social sites, and, of course, the website, joshtully.com, joshtolley.com. While you're there, pick up a copy of Evangelpreneur, and this is the last week to get your tickets to Dallas if you want to come. Do not hesitate. Do not procrastinate. Get on the plane and make it happen. All right, so including the gunman, 12 people were shot at the Grand Theater in Lafayette last night. Officials said the number of injured has risen up to 7. Wait a second. Oh, gotcha. From 7 up till 9, 3 people died in the shooting, including the shooter. Police are not yet publicly identifying the shooter, but he's a 58-year-old white male. He was evidently in the theater watching the movie like everybody else. Then at a point in the movie, he stood up and started shooting a semi-automatic handgun. The first two people he shot were directly in front of him. Two police officers were very close to the theater and were able to respond to the scene in less than a minute. In less than 60 seconds, police were there. Officers entered the theater as a stream of theatergoers fled, and as the officers entered, the gunman shot himself. The theater was, in fact, a gun-free zone. That's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. I think sometimes we see these stories and we just, you know, get into the politics of it. We get into the policy of it. Oh, well, see, should be a theater that allows guns, and see, Josh, this is why we carry guns, and all that, you know, and all that sort of stuff is legit. We're going to be talking about it in a minute, but I think that happens too often now. And I think we lose sight of the fact that 2 innocent people are dead. They're dead. They're not coming home. They're not going to be going to another movie ever. They're not going to be seeing their family for Thanksgiving. They're dead. 9 other people are going to be scarred for life. In various states of injury. And yeah, it is a situation that leads to political discussion and social discussion. I get it. But we just lose the fact that they're dead. That has become such a light issue nowadays. People used to see stories like this in the news, and they would cry. They would be shaken all day. And no, I'm not talking about the 50s. I'm not talking about the 60s. When Columbine happened, that shook people for weeks. For weeks. There were people afraid to go to their school. There were people who were seeing counselors just because of how depressed they got, knowing that a bunch of kids were just gunned down in a school in the middle of the day, just bleeding and wondering where are their parents, where is help, and instead their hearts stopped beating. And today we just, oh, man, did you hear about the shooting in Louisiana? Oh, for lunch today. We become hardened. And that's sad. And the reason it's sad is because that's